This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks.
In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Well, you know how the rest of the poem goes.
Indians, Indians, Columbus cried. His heart was filled with joyful pride.
But India, the land was not. It was the Bahamas, and it was hot.
The Arakawa natives were very nice. They gave the sailors food and spice.
Okay, so the poem, let's be honest, is an extreme, almost embarrassing simplification of the cataclysmic change brought to the New World by Columbus and subsequent explorers. Not just to the native peoples, but to the environment, ecology, and biology of the continent and the world.
Or as Charles Mann puts it, there is a growing recognition that Columbus's voyage did not mark the discovery of a new world, but its creation. And how that world was created is the subject of his new book, 1493.
Charles Mann joins us now from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst, where he's based. Charles Mann, welcome to Radio Boston.
That's a pleasure to talk with you.
It's a true pleasure to have you on the program. The book is outstanding. It is such a tour de force that took me back into time and in through biology and history. But I wonder if I might ask you first, you sort of start by what inspired you, and that in part was things that you're growing in your own garden there in central Massachusetts. Can you tell us what's growing in the garden and why it gives us a window onto this world of what happened in 1493 and beyond?
Well, in fact, what's growing in my garden now is a little bit less than what was growing because the hurricane took out some of it. But over the years, I've grown tomatoes, kale, basil, you know, peppers of every sort, you know, the kind of things that you grow in your garden. And, of course, I'm very proud of having my own local foods and vegetables. But it wasn't until I started looking at them more and reading about, you know, what I was growing that I realized that not one of the things in my garden came from within 1,000 miles of this place. And here, of course, I'm, you know, a big local food advocate. But almost everything that I'm eating actually comes from very far away. And I began to sort of wonder how that had occurred.
And you, in your book, you explore this idea that maybe might be familiar to some listeners, but it's this theory that you admit you did not come up with at first, but something called the Columbian Exchange. Now, what is that?
Well, there's a wonderful book that was published in 1972 by a terrific historian and geographer named Alfred W. Crosby. And he was the first, really, to put this idea together. And what he said was that the true impact of Columbus was this. As you probably learned in school, there's 250 million years ago a single giant landmass that scientists call Pangaea, and geological forces broke it up. And as a result, the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere developed entirely different suites of plants and animals. And what Columbus did was bring the continents back together, in effect. He brought these ecosystems that have been separated for millions of years together, and the result was this enormous exchange, as huge numbers of plants and animals and other species from over there came over here, and huge numbers of plants and animals and other species from over here came over there, and it was an enormous ecological convulsion, the greatest event in the history of life since the death of the dinosaurs. And it underlies a huge amount of the history we learn in school.
Now, this is really fascinating to me because I think some people might say that is a very sweeping statement to say that the age of exploration a half millennium ago is equivalent in nature ecologically to the extinction of the dinosaurs. Because, I mean, we started this segment where you mentioning what happened to your garden after Tropical Storm Irene blew through it. I mean, haven't there always been other forces, non-human forces, that have moved species around from continent to continent? I mean, hurricanes are a good example of that.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, that's a leading theory of how the sweet potato, which comes from Central America, ended up in Polynesian societies. But there is nothing like this. Here in a very short period of time, in a century or so, you had every ecosystem that's on a habitable part of the Earth brought into contact with every other. And there's probably not a single place on Earth that hasn't been dramatically changed by the Columbian Exchange. And so that's what I mean. The scale of it is really enormous. And then you add the fact that so many different species ended up in such different places. You're looking at a gigantic reassortment of the distribution of life on the planet. And by the way, you'd have to include human beings in that. I mean, we're a perfect example of the sort of scale of what happened. Before Columbus, basically all Europeans were in Europe, all people of African descent were in Africa, and the Americas were full of Native Americans, and Asia was full of Asians. And, you know, within a century, you have huge numbers of Africans being brought over to the Americas, Europeans scattered all over the place. You have a Chinatown in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, just this crazy wholesale overturning of the apple cart in regard to our species, in regard to species all over the world.
Well, I wonder if we might, for the next little bit, sort of focus our conversation on how we see this gigantic blend or exchange of species that was, you know, triggered by the Columbian Exchange, how we see that made manifest here in New England. I mean, you're based in Amherst. One of the earliest post-Columbian settlements in Massachusetts was, of course, Plymouth Plantation. I wonder could we start there? And can you just describe to us sort of what the settlers in Plymouth Plantation, to remind us, what they arrived at, what they saw when they first got here, and how we can measure the change that happened thereafter?
Well, Plymouth was established on top of an Indian village called Patuxet. And as, you know, if you look at the Pilgrim Chronicles, you'll find that they knew this perfectly well. The Patuxet was deserted, and the reason it was deserted was that an epidemic of European disease had come in a few years before the Pilgrims and wiped out populations all over coastal New England. And so that was the Columbian Exchange, you know, an invisible species, probably viral hepatitis, according to sort of the latest guesses, but it could have been something else. Came over from Europe, probably brought in the bodies of shipwrecked French sailors who landed in Cape Cod. And as the Pilgrims put it, they cleared the way for them to arrive. And so they came to a landscape that had been suddenly radically depopulated. And this story that I'm telling you about New England was no accident. It happened all over the Americas as diseases that didn't exist in the Americas were imported accidentally by Europeans and brought to populations that had no experience with them. And between 1500 and 1650, somewhere between two-thirds and 90%, nobody knows the exact percentage, of the people in the Americas died. And this allowed Europeans to come in to these suddenly emptied landscapes. And so this is how small groups of Europeans at the ends of enormously long supply chains were able to come in and establish themselves in places that until recently had been inhabited by huge Native American populations.
Two-thirds of the people, you said.
Something like that.
Something
again, we don't really know. Estimates are typically between two-thirds, and some of them go up as high as 90%. But it was just an enormous cataclysm in human terms. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in the history of the world, so far as we know.
And that's
a small part of the Columbian Exchange. That's the reason that people talk about it as being such a large-scale event, to go back to your earlier question.
And a small and hidden part, as you said.
Yeah.
You know, we've done previous programs here on Radio Boston that, you know, speak about, for example, the Puritans and how one great surprise in archaeological digs that have been done in Boston is that the Puritans weren't an isolated group just living within their means in then marshy Boston Harbor, but that they were members of a very vibrant, this is much later, of course, but they were members of a very vibrant trade that is evidenced by the fact that they were wearing very intricate lace and they were eating olives and things like that in a colony that you would think would not have been that well plugged into the world. And I raise this as just an example of it and to get your sense as to how quickly after 1492 or the early English settlements in both Massachusetts and Virginia, how quickly do we see this sort of exponential growth in the exchange of species?
It happens really quickly in the Caribbean where the Spaniards first come. When Columbus comes back in 1493 for his second voyage, that's when he tries to establish his first permanent colony, La Isabela, which is on Hispaniola, which is the big island that now has the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And the colony's a failure, but its legacy is everywhere there, because he brought in cattle, he brought in horses, he brought in wheat, he brought in sugarcane, he brought in just numerous species there and established them in this island. And now botanists there tell me that something like two-thirds of the plants and animals in the Caribbean are exotics, are from somewhere else. And then this continued in the 1520s when Cortez conquered conquered Mexico, and just as conquered the Aztec Empire, just as an example, shortly after the conquest, he found three wheat grains in a sack of rice that they had brought along, and he instructed this African who was traveling with him to plant them. And the story goes that all the wheat that is now in Mexico, for which people make tortillas and numerous other things, came originally from those three grains of wheat. And then the story I was also told, I haven't found any scholarly evidence for this, but I've certainly told it a lot by local farmers in Mexico, was that the Spaniards brought that wheat up into Texas and then from there went into the Middle West. And so that the amber waves of grain that we see in the Middle West originally came from Mexico, where they were planted by an African slave who got them in a sack of Chinese rice. Huh. So this is the kind of exchange that you're talking about.
Huh. Well, I think one of the most powerful sort of lines of inquiry that you draw in the book 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created, is that draws the connection between the resources that the quote unquote New World had to offer, and the labor that was required to harvest those resources, in other words, slavery, and diseases that made slavery a more attractive economical option than it should have been. So I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that. I mean, there's a quote in your book where you say slavery would have existed in the Americas without a particular parasite, and that parasite being the one that causes malaria. And then you say in 1641, Massachusetts, which had little malaria, became the first English colony to legalize slavery explicitly. So help us understand this relationship between malaria and slavery.
This is building on work of innumerable historians, I should say. So what I'm doing is gathering together a lot of other people's work and building on it. So it's important to note that I'm just not making this up, that there's a great deal of other people's work that I am trying to summarize. But the way it begins is this, that in the 15th and 16th century and the 17th century, the wet parts of England, which are southeast England, were full of malaria, a particular kind of malaria called vivax malaria. Malaria is caused by this single-celled parasite, Plasmodium, and it has two important species. One is vivax, and that was all over Europe, but particularly in places that are wet, like southeast England. And then the other is falciparum. That's the more dangerous of the two, and that's in Africa. And it seems pretty clear that, for reasons we can go into more detail if you want to, that malaria had come, the sort of European version of it had come to the Americas by 1640 and probably, 10 to 20 years earlier.
And how had it come to the Americas by that time?
In the bodies of English people.
Okay.
Malaria is this very fiendishly clever disease. That's why it hasn't been possible to eradicate it despite decades of efforts. And one of the things it can do is hide out in the body. The parasites can go into a kind of dormant state and hide out in the spleen, and then months or even years later can reemerge. They swarm in the bloodstream, and then they are transmitted by mosquitoes. And so if a mosquito bites you while you're sick and takes some of your blood, the next person that it bites, it infects. And that's the way that the disease is transmitted. And there is a mosquito in New England, actually all over the eastern seaboard, called Anopheles quadrimaculatus. That is a very capable, as they call it, a malaria vector. Now, what's interesting is that then any Europeans who came over here for in these malarial areas, which tended to be in the warmer parts, very quickly got sick. And this is a process called seasoning. Then when the second type of malaria came over, falciparum, which is much more temperature sensitive, it really became deadly for Europeans kind of south of Chesapeake Bay. Chesapeake Bay and south, I should say. And at that point, the equation for labor changed. Europeans initially had brought over indentured servants. Indentured servants are where you pay for somebody's passage, and then they work for you for a term, typically 5 to 7 years, and then you let them go.
Mm-hmm.
But if you paid for somebody's passage, which is very expensive, and then they expired on you or were sick for a year and a half, you know, it started not looking like a very good deal. Whereas if you could bring Africans over, Africans from, you know, by quirks of genetics, happen to be the most malaria-immune people on the planet, Western Africans in particular. They're completely immune to vivax malaria, which is one type, which is the type of European malaria. And it's kind of complicated, but you can sort of say they're sort of half immune to the other type. And that tipped the scales. And there's a British historian, Philip Curtin, a great historian, who has sort of done the math and says that the African was a better deal, at up, even if it cost as much as 3 times as much as the indentured servant. And that kind of puts the thumb on the scales. And in areas where there's a lot of malaria, which is the warmer parts of the of North America, you suddenly start getting societies that are very dependent on slaves. All the American colonies had slaves. As we said, Massachusetts was the first to legalize it explicitly. The Pilgrims actually opened up another colony on an island in the Caribbean, and they had huge numbers of slaves there. But only in areas where malaria was really prevalent did you get the kind of slave society that you saw in the Southeast, like in places like South Carolina.
Well, and then you write about how malaria actually played a role in the American Revolution.
Yeah, and I think there's a this is pretty widely accepted. By the time of the American Revolution, we're now dealing in the 18th century, England had taken some steps to drain the bogs and drain the fens. And so as a result, there was much less malaria in England. And they also had a lot of troops from the northern part of England, where there really isn't malaria because it's too cold. And they came and executed what's called the Southern Strategy, which is led by General Cornwallis. They went into the south, into places like the Carolinas, with the hope of that there was all these loyalists who would come and join them, and they would be able to, in this way, take back a lot of the what became the United States. And instead, malaria came and kind of wiped out their army. And Cornwallis had to lead his sick army and out of there. And unfortunately, they ended up in Chesapeake Bay, which is one of the epicenters of the malaria epidemic. And George Washington came in and took advantage of this. And the British simply couldn't fight back. They had too many sick people. And the result was that Cornwallis surrendered, which was the effective end of the Revolutionary War. Now, I don't want to say that, you know, the human bravery and, you know, great leadership from people like Washington wasn't a major factor, but you know, Anopheles quadrimaculatus should be taught. You know, that name should be taught in every history of the American Revolution as well.
I'm speaking with Charles Mann. He's author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. He's speaking to us from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst. You know, Mr. Mann, in listening to you and reading your book, which is this just sweeping ecological history of what happened when explorers both, you know, took and brought new species on purpose and inadvertently around the world, and the effect that that has had on history, it really kind of, in the last couple of minutes, I'm wondering if we could discuss how, what effect that has on our understanding of the transport of species today. And the reason why I ask is because for many years now, people have been extraordinarily concerned about invasives. You know, the Asian longhorn beetle, for example, is very much in the news, and what that might do to the trees of Massachusetts. And I know that any time a tanker vessel comes into the port of Boston, for example, or other ports in New England, there's this concern of what might come out of the bilge in the tanker.
But, an entirely justified concern.
But really, because I wonder, like, your book seems to make me think that invasives are just as much a part of our local ecosystem as any other and have been for 500 years.
Well, I think the problem here is that we're conflating two separate issues. One are exotics, and those are just creatures that are from not around here. And most of them are perfectly terrific. I don't think anybody would want to kick tomatoes out of Massachusetts. You know, we all go to the farmer's market and we sort of ooh and ah, you know, right now in this season over the wonderful tomatoes we have. But they're obviously not from around here. Invasive is a species that's really a problem and causes, you know, grows where we don't want it and has impacts, has effects that we don't like. And there's plenty of native species that are invasive. And so the only problem is with the minority of exotic species that are invasive. And it seems to me that there's a number of relatively simple, not so expensive things that we can do to at least slow their spread. I mean, how much would we like it if we had been able to slow the spread of the gypsy moth, mm-hmm. which was introduced in the 1860s by this obsessed French guy in Boston, actually. I think it was in Medford. If we'd had some agency that was looking out for these things, we would, you know, have saved ourselves a lot of trouble. I think the same thing is true for the Asian longhorn beetle, which apparently came in shipping pallets. And if there was, X-rays or something in the shipping pallet companies in China that zapped the newly made pallets and killed whatever critters were living inside it, this wouldn't cost a fortune and might have saved us a lot of problems. So I think there's, sort of simple common sense steps that we can take that would at least slow this process down, make it more manageable, while not, sacrificing the tremendous benefits that we all get from world trade.
Well, that's Charles Mann. He is author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. He spoke with us today from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst. Charles Mann, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And best of luck to your garden. And hope it COVID recovers from Irene.
Thank you.
Well, we'll be back after a short break. Up next...
Somehow I internalized the lesson that literature is written by men, about men, for men.
A conversation with writer Jennifer Haig in our series, Zip Code Stories. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.